listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 37th edition of our conversation with Professor Luciana Bone about the history of the Soviet Union. We've been working through some of the myths about Stalin's time at the helm at the Soviet Union. And today, myth number four has to do with the non-aggression pact that was signed between the USSR and Hitler's Germany to buy time for the Soviet Union to build its defenses, also known as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, and we're going to discuss that today. Luciana, a pleasure to speak with you.
Yes, thank you very much. Indeed, we will be talking about the what is known as the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. So what was it? First of all, the official title of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact is Treaty of Non-Aggression between Germany and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. It was signed on 24 August 1939, that's just a week before Hitler invaded Poland, and set off World War II. I have organized this speech, this conversation, in terms of questions and answers, so I'm going to proceed, but please, with questions and then answers, but please jump in when you want to add, as usual.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Second question, was the Soviet Union alone among European powers to sign such a pact? No. In August 1938, the Soviet Union was the last of the European powers to sign a pact of non-aggression with Germany. Now, some of the pacts signed with Hitler's Germany in the 1930s by European powers were The pact between Germany and Poland in 1934, which, if we follow the Molotov-Ribbentrop nomenclature, we would kill it. We would call it the Hitler-Pilsudski pact, but we don't. Then, in 29 September 1938, well, a year before the Soviet Union, we had the Munich Agreement, which involved Germany, Great Britain, France, and Italy. And that's 1938, the Munich, you know, it's called the Munich Agreement, but it was really a pact between these four countries to cut up Czechoslovakia. I'll refer to that later. Then we have the German. Then we have the Pact of Non-Aggression by Great Britain, which followed by one day the Munich Agreement. So this should be called the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact, but right. It isn't.
Right.
Then we have France signing a Pact of Non-Aggression on 6 December 1938, and we should call it the Hitler-Daladier pact, but we don't. And then we have, in June of 1939, Pact of Non-Aggression by Estonia, which should be called Selter-Ribbentrop Pact, but it isn't. And finally, we have, in June of 1939, we have Latvia's Pact of Non-Aggression with Germany, which should be called the Munters-Ribbentrop Pact, but it isn't.
Right. You know what's interesting also, by the way, aside from the fact that there were all of these different agreements entered into between all of these various countries and Germany at that time, you also had, going back to the Treaty of Rapallo in 1922, a series of agreements between Germany and the Soviet Union for non-aggression in 1922, the Berlin Treaty in 1926, and some protocols that were added to that subsequently all the way up through 1935. So, you know, everybody there, I mean, these people are bound by their borders to, you know, be neighbors. Everyone there looking at their common history and the current situation that they found themselves in, entered into treaties to not go to war with each other, and that's the process that they followed until, of course, Hitler went to war with everybody.
Right. There was nothing unusual about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact. You're quite correct. Of course, in the 1920s was the Weimar Republic.
That's right. That wasn't Hitler. That was with Weimar. That's right.
Yeah, it was Weimar, which was cut off by the Versailles Treaty from, you know, from dealing with anybody.
Right. World War One.
At any rate. But that's a different story. So now, next question is, did the Soviet Union invade Poland in 1939 together with Hitler? These two questions, the Poland invasion and the Ribbentrop, the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, go together. And as I proceed, you know, the listeners will realize why I ask this question at this point. What does it have to do with the... They might wonder, what does it have to do with the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact? Well, it does. So I asked that question, and so did the Soviet Union invade Poland? No. The Red Army moved into territories ruled by Poland that had been ruled by Poland since 1920. The Red Army did not invade Poland together with Hitler, as the impression is given. But in reaction to and after 2 weeks of Hitler's invasion of Poland, this was, you know, the idea was, as will be clearer later, that Hitler and Stalin planned to divide Poland among themselves. But the question, there are so many questions. What was Poland, you know, after Hitler invaded? So here we go. 16 days after Hitler invaded Poland, he made it in September 1st, and 3 weeks after the signing of the so-called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, the Soviet army occupied, now listen to this, the territory of Polish Belarus, which had belonged to Russia in 1917, and the territory of Western Ukraine, Galicia, which had been a part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire and was then given to control of Poland after World War One. Right. I hope this is not too intricate. Both these territories had been taken by Poland, that is, so-called Polish Belarus, I mean, it's just Belarus, territories of Belarus, and Western Ukraine. They had been taken by Poland in the Polish-Russian Republic War, that is, after 1920. Now, the majority of people living in these territories were Russian speakers, Russians, particularly in Belarus. I think there was a million difference in Western Ukraine. So this is what, in 1939, now is called Poland. They are basically formerly Russian territories, Tsar Russian territories. So there is a kind of myth in claiming that the Soviet Union invaded Poland. So as we noted, many countries in the 1930s and even before, as you pointed out, countries signed agreements with Hitler. And of course, the most infamous of these was the Munich Agreement, which should be better known as the Munich Betrayal, because in that September of 1938, Hitler convened Benito Mussolini, Britain's Chamberlain, and France's Daladier to decide the fate of Czechoslovakia, very much like the United States today decides the fate of Syria or Nicaragua or, you know, any other. Now, at this Munich conference agreement betrayal, there was no representative from Czechoslovakia or the USSR at these negotiations. Poland was a kind of fifth wheel in the background because Poland had a fascist government, a nationalist fascist government. Poland eagerly signed the agreement partitioning Czechoslovakia and took for itself a chunk of it. So, dear old Poland and, you know, Polish spirit, it's high now. Nationalism is high in Poland, so they are. There is a distortion of these facts. So today, the nationalist government of Poland says that that the Soviet Union invaded Poland, and now destroys the monuments to the Red Army, for example, which liberated Poland from the Nazis. But the fact is that in 1939. The League of Nations did not condemn the Soviet Union for attacking Poland. It recognized the borders of Western Russia as established as a result of and after the Nazi invasion and occupation of Poland. You see, it was a cause and effect situation. And the invasion of Poland, now if you look at the geographic chart, Warsaw is very close to what is now the western border of Russia. Of Russia today, these names are confusing. But at any rate, so Hitler invaded practically the whole of Poland with a little slice that could still be called Polish. And then it's Polish dominated territories in Belarus and Ukraine. Is that clear?
Yeah, and there's more to it, too. if you look at some
of the Curzon line,
well, that too. But if you look at some of the lands that were the subject of this 1939 non-aggression pact, among them are the Baltic states. Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, and those have been, recently, I would say since, the 1980s, the domain of the CIA and the U.S. Efforts to first break up the Warsaw Pact and then the Soviet Union, and now they're more or less the territory for the forward basing of NATO military facilities to Russia's borders, and that includes... which is the interesting thing. I don't think people here in the United States understood when you had German, NATO tanks with Germans rolling through Poland into the Baltic states last summer, what that meant to the people on the ground there, including, the one-third to a half the population of those countries that are Russians.
That's right. And let's not forget that the that when Germany rolled into those Baltic states, there was a cleansing of Jews, too.
Yep.
In Vilnius, etc. So, there's the other thing, that the Hitler's invasion of the 1st of September 1939, what happened is that Poland ceased to exist. There was, after the invasion, the Polish government fled to Bucharest in Romania,
right,
leaving the Polish people to their fate. And this happened in Italy, too. Yeah. But German invasion, the king flees, leaves the people.
They always manage to bring their money with them, though. I don't know how they manage that, but they always do, don't they?
Yeah. The fascists, great heroes. Really valiant. So, the Polish government fled to Bucharest in Romania, leaving the Polish people to their fate. There was no way for Germany even to conclude a ceasefire, not that
right.
they cared.
There was no one to sign it. Right.
So Poland was without government. This is why the League of Nations did not condemn the move of the Red Army into Belarus and Western Ukraine, Galicia. They recognized that there were other reasons behind historical from the 18th century on, but they recognized that that was the that there needed to be a border between invading Germany and the Soviet Union.
Right, a buffer.
The League of Nations throughout the Soviet Union when it invaded Finland, which was Hitler's closest ally.
Right.
And, the Soviet Union attempted that. And they condemned that, but they did not condemn the move of the Red Army into what is called Poland. Incorrectly, since it had held those territories for just, 20 years?
Right. And by the way, for folks that don't understand this, much of Finland was actually Russia for hundreds of years.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of, you start to ask questions. You have to start to ask questions. And then the answers are so complicated, but not really. And Poland, this same government that fled, that government was the first in Europe to sign the Pact of Non-Aggression with Hitler's Germany, in 1934, 1 year after Hitler had assumed full power. And this, too, was the government that refused repeated offers of a pact of non-aggression, a sort of an anti-fascist alliance, and protection from the, repeated offers of protection and non-aggression pact from the Soviet Union.
Right.
This government had refused those. On the contrary, as we noted, Poland was an accomplice and beneficiary of the Munich Agreement,
right.
Which should be better called collaboration with Hitler.
That's the one they refer to. That's the one that they refer to as Chamberlain as what's the word that they use in
the appeaser.
The appeasement. Yeah, right. That was the
appeasement. Appeasement.
You know,
it was complete cooperation.
Right. Go ahead. You could have Czechoslovakia. Go ahead. No problem. And so everybody took it, like Mel Brooks says, a little slice of Turkey, a little daub of Greece. I took a train back in 1990 from what was then Leningrad to Warsaw, which went through or around Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania into Warsaw. And at the border at the time, and this is while, you know, Poland was still in the Warsaw Pact, or actually had just left, I think, because it was June of 1990, so I think Poland had just left the Soviet arrangement. We had to get out of the car of our train, and then they lifted the cars of the train off the carriage and took them to a parallel track that had other carriages that were a different gauge. They were wider. And the purpose of that was so that Germany could never again roll in military equipment into the Soviet Union using the rails, that the gauge of the rail system that came from Germany through Poland ended there, and a different sized track began there going into the Soviet Union. Yeah, it was interesting, like an interesting remnant of
very
history.
Interesting. Okay, so next question, why is only the Soviet non-aggression pact called Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact? This is interesting. It's a minor piece of propaganda maneuver, but it's significant. So we know that Ribbentrop was hanged at Nuremberg as a war criminal.
That's right.
The first Nuremberg trial, the trial of the Nazi elite. So coupling Molotov with Ribbentrop is sort of throwing the Soviet foreign minister in the company of a Nazi war criminal. So, for example, the British never referred to the document signed, their non-aggression pact, signed on September 1938 by Adolf Hitler and Great Britain's Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain. They never call it the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact. The Poles who signed the treaty in 1934 never referred to it as the Pilsudski-Hitler Pact. So the leaders of Poland, Great Britain, and France all shook hands with Hitler. Joseph Stalin never did. So, you know, that's just a bit of...
Right. Hey, you know, the proof is in the pudding, okay? What happened was, as soon as Hitler advanced up to the, you know, portions of Poland that were part of this, you know, agreement, that they prepared for an invasion of the Soviet Union, which they effected within a year and a half afterwards. So,
And then the other, I don't remember what number of my questions this is, but then, you know, the question would be this, but didn't the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact have a secret agreement with Germany to divide and share, they say, parts of Europe, Latvia, you know, the Baltic states, which I haven't mentioned? Didn't they have a secret agreement? Yes. There were two secret protocols added to the pact. One on the signing of the pact on the night of 23-24 August 1939, 7 days before the Nazi invasion of Poland, and the other secret protocol on 28 September, 28 days after the Nazi invasion of Poland. And these were stipulations that were made in August before the invasion and in September after the invasion of Poland. These were phrased in this way: in the event of the alteration of the present national borders of Poland or the Baltic countries should they occur after August 23. Now, they occurred in September. Hitler took Poland. Now, the pact is very short. Anybody can read it. It has 7 articles and 2 added protocols. And this is what the fuss is all about. That together Hitler and Soviet and Stalin planned to divide up the loot that supposedly happened at the time of the Hitler and Stalin invasion of Poland, which is, I tried to explain, didn't occur at the same time, didn't occur in harmony. One was the consequence of the other.
Right.
And so what the secret protocols determine is where Nazi Germany will stop and the Soviet Union will begin, meaning that this line, both, you know, in Lithuania and in Poland, beyond that would imply an invasion. Would
right.
imply war between, it would imply a violation of the Pact of Non-Aggression. And these two protocols have this phrase, in the event of the changed situation, of the changed political situation of Poland, we will determine that this is the line where Germany will stop here in the Baltic and here in Ukraine.
That's all. That's exactly right. It was clear
right?
from watching what Hitler was doing at the time, it was clear that he was, you know, stretching out his arms for that Lebensraum, you know, for that living space, for that.
Yeah.
All the Germany was going to, you know, draw in a deep breath and snatch as much of the world as Hitler thought that it needed. And certainly, having spoken and written of it for something like, at this point, 15 years, the Soviet Union was included within that. And so all of the real estate between the Soviet Union and Germany was to be looked at as a chessboard to
that's
prepare
right.
for that invasion, which did come pretty
yeah,
shortly
that's
thereafter.
That's it. And so I think this is might be my last question. But people might say, wasn't all this dealing and sharing with Hitler proof that the USSR was allied with him?
That's ridiculous.
No, these were measures to protect the Soviet Union from Hitler, not a partnership with Hitler. Now, supposing the Soviet Union had not signed this document, what would have happened? Would Hitler not have attacked Poland? Of course he would have.
Right.
He had already decided, as intelligence shows, to invade Poland in April, as scholars have attested. In addition, and I mean, it's hard to believe that the Soviet Union didn't know that there was an impending invasion of Poland just a week before they signed the pact. It's impossible to believe that they didn't know.
Of course they knew.
So, in addition, if the Soviet Union had not annexed Belarus and Western Ukraine in September 1939, well, Germany would have snapped them up as they did in 1941, and they would have served then in 1939 as the highway to Moscow and Leningrad in 1939 when there is a further complication. The Soviet Union benefited some degree from the pact by gaining extra time. This is really crucial. And buffer territories. The strength of the Red Army in 1939 compared to 1941 is very, very different. In 1941, the Red Army outmanned and outgunned the army of 1939. In other words, the army was not prepared, especially after the attempted coup of the that was exposed in the Moscow trials.
Right.
Now, Germany had occupied all of what was then what was then Polish territory in 1939, the Wehrmacht would have been that much closer to Moscow and Leningrad. And as we know, in 1941, they besieged Leningrad and came within kilometers, was it 30, of Moscow. So gaining that time, sure, was crucial.
Absolutely. It ended up being the thing that decided the outcome of the war.
Absolutely.
No matter how many movies they make in Hollywood showing that all of that took place in France with the United States.
We've
got to come back to this.
Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's okay. We're going to have to come back to this next week. And that's going to move us right into myth number five, which has to do with exactly what happened with the actual war itself. The Soviet Union did. This is the myth. The Soviet Union invaded Poland, and not exactly the truth, at least not that time. So, Luciana, thank you so much. It's a pleasure, and I'm really enjoying working through some of this history.
My pleasure with you, Don, always. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. We live in surreal times. A short time ago, even imagining a negotiated end to the tensions on the Korean Peninsula was a flight into fancy. But here we are. Is this becoming a foreign policy victory for Trump? Crosstalking Trump's foreign policy, I'm joined by my guest, Mark Sloboda. He's an international affairs and security analyst. We also have Xavier Moreau. He is the founder of the Center for Political Strategic Analysis, StratPol. And we have Dmitry Babich. He is a political analyst with Sputnik International. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want. And I always appreciate it. Xavier, let me go to you first. We're going to devote a good part of this program to what's going on in the Korean Peninsula. However, the president of the country that you come from, France, was visiting the United States. How would you sum up Macron's visit? Because if you want my two cents, it was quite humiliating for the French president.
Quite humiliating, it's exactly the word I would like to use. And in my opinion, Trump again showed that he very well prepared his meeting with the different chief of state. And in my opinion, he heard some rumors, because it was in some medias, that Emmanuel Macron has a special sexual orientation. And so he played with him. And,
He looked like he was being played with.
I think
even if you're not really interested in politics, the visuals of their encounter, it's gone viral. And everyone's laughing, okay?
But, I'm not trying to protect.
Exactly, Mark. Exactly.
You got some dandruff there, Frenchie.
Exactly.
We want you to be perfect.
You can hit him if you want.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah. I'm not trying to protect Emmanuel Macron, but in my opinion, Donald Trump is unacceptable. And in my opinion, it's a mistake, because Emmanuel Macron came really as a friend to Trump. And he just has given the evidence that he's a loyal feudal, I can tell.
Yeah, because
we bombed together the Syria.
I guess the top line was he tried to dissuade Trump from leaving the Iran deal, but he didn't get anything, okay?
Anything.
He had to admit to media that, well, I didn't change his mind. But apparently he made Trump commit to staying in Syria.
It reminds me Nicolas Sarkozy, because when Nicolas Sarkozy was chosen by French people. He was Sarkozy American. He made his first speech just after being elected about how the U.S. Have to be our great friend. The problem is Obama came as a president, and Obama, I don't know why, hated Sarkozy. Because Sarkozy supported...
I didn't like him very much either.
No, actually,
I'm with Obama. cases when we agree with Obama.
In my opinion, it was because Sarkozy was supporting the Republicans. But the result is Sarkozy, after 1 year at power, understand that the real friend of Nicolas Sarkozy was the Russian. Because when he came in Russia, and I hope it will be the same for Emmanuel Macron, right, within 4 weeks, when he came in Russia, he was welcome like...
And we have to admit, you know, going back through history here, one of his foreign policy successes was to be involved in the mediation of ending this, the conflict in south of Ossetia. Okay.
Yeah.
Dima, jump in. You're a Frenchophile.
I don't know about body language, but let's look at the facts. That was the first visit by a leader of a major European country since Trump came to power. When Trump came to power, Macron said, and the leaders of the European Union said, that Trump and Putin were, I'm quoting, a threat to European democracy, that they were dangerous. So when did Trump stop to be dangerous? Not when he was elected.
He stopped being dangerous when he started bombing Syria.
Exactly. When he started bombing Syria,
let's finish up on this because I don't really want to dig into Korea.
Let's get past the optics of the bromance from Trump leading Macron along like a newlywed or a little French poodle to the album cover, the alternative rock album cover of them all planting trees in the yard together in very awkward, very strange poses. But, the reality is right after that, Macron went and spoke to Congress and spoke quite vehemently against every one of Trump's policies and beliefs. So, I don't think Trump was fooled. Macron didn't get anything that he came out of there. This was all about optics and all of these Western media journalists commenting on body language and bringing in body language experts and everything. It's all ridiculous.
But Mark, because I agree with it was ridiculous. But that's kind of the default position when there is no substance, and there was no real
Macron
substance.
Macron is now being hailed after Merkel has failed as the new leader of the free world, right? The new leader of the free world just bombed Syria, saying it was for the honor of the international community, or at least the two, Trump and his two client states that attacked Syria, their honor.
Sykes-Picot.
He also said that part of his reason for doing it was to prove that he is the equal of Putin.
Yes.
Macron, you dear it's little Obama. Globalist bankster, Rothschild bankster, you are no Vladimir Putin.
It reminds me Obama, Barack Obama, during the last years of his mandate as a president, always explained that, no, I win against Putin. Putin never talked about it, but he was always explaining, no, it's me. I played Putin. I win the fight.
Pigeon chess. Macron is a grandmaster of pigeon chess.
Okay.
Just to be more serious. In my opinion, Macron really wants to be the white Obama.
Yes.
And if you listen to what he said when he was in the United States, for instance, it's not politics. It's he will save the planet, for instance. There is no planet B. He has some communicants who prepare such, formula.
He should have met with Trudeau. I think he probably would have been happier.
I think he wants to be the little emperor that couldn't.
He's the first Brahmins, actually, before Trump, the first Brahmins is between Emmanuel Macron and Trudeau.
All right, I'm going to hold my nose on that one there. Gentlemen, let's talk about some real substance here. Dima, things are moving quite quickly on the Korean Peninsula. I've been following it very closely like everyone else, but I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding in Western media about what's really going on. Because what's really going on is the Koreans deciding their fate, irrespective of who wants to take credit for it. You know what I mean?
I like the headline that the Moon of Obama gave to its article describing this meeting. A most hopeful Korean summit with little chance of final success.
That's just building it in there. Failure is okay. Well, I mean, is the only option.
If it had been just between Koreans, the problem would have been solved long ago. We see that there is no real perennial animosity. There is no real hurdle between Koreans. The problem is not about North Korea not being able to reform itself. It is reforming itself. The problem is with the Western world, which in the last 20 years changed completely, changed beyond recognition, and which cannot agree to any kind of compromise, even if that allows to lessen the nuclear danger.
The underlining thing that no one talks about, Mark, in Western media, because most Western media, they don't know what they're talking about anything most of the time, is that the Koreans may determine their own destiny without an outside power. Mm-hmm. This is something that is hard to stomach in the swamp.
I've got three examples to bring that home for you. The New York Times. The New York Times has a Twitter account, the New York Times at War, which focuses on their war coverage.
Who knew?
Which they had an article, with cameras rolling, Korea's leaders put a peaceful spin on propaganda. And the New York Times at War header was, the moment in which Kim and Mr. Moon stepped on the border was one of several images that displayed both countries' understanding of the propaganda value of political theater. Well, this is a cautionary warning about peace from the New York Times at War.
Yes.
Number two, Fortune magazine. South Korea and North Korea handshakes, peace talks hurt U.S. defense stocks. Okay, who's here isn't winning from the deglobalization?
God forbid.
The five largest U.S. military industrial complex contractors lost $10.2 billion in one day. Who will cry when peace occurs to Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Boeing? And last but not least, I give you a reporter from the U.S. military Stars and Stripes newspaper, Bob Reed. He commented, North and South Korea agree on denuclearization of the peninsula, but fall short of specifics, which is true yet. True. Is President Moon seeking a separate peace with the North, sidestepping the all-important U.S. security interests?
You see, this is it. This is what Western media and the think tanks, they can't comprehend. It's not about them.
Yeah.
This is their real big problem here. No, it's very interesting is that the North Korean regime, if we can use that word, this is a very calculated plan on their part. Mm-hmm. And they understood what happened in Libya. They understood what happened in Iraq. Okay? So they come to the peace table strong and supporting and with nuclear weapons and with the goal of maintaining their sovereignty. I don't understand what's going on in the think tanks in Washington, D.C. This is as patently obvious as it gets.
Okay, there is a country we talked to, Northern and Southern Korea, is Russia. Southern
and
Korea.
And China.
And China is a special zone of influence. But if there is a reconciliation between North and South Korea, who will lose? The U.S. Because no need to have some U.S. troops anymore.
30,000 U.S. troops still stationed.
Do you have any idea how much a year that?
It's huge, I'm sure. And not only in South Korea, in Japan.
In Japan?
Yeah.
Oh, the Japanese don't want to see this happen. Oh, they don't,
because
guys.
There are historical animosities between the Koreans and Japan.
The globalist ideology will also lose. That would be the other major loser, not just the United States, because I don't think it's in the United States' national interest to have three aircraft carriers permanently stationed right next to North Korea.
Not the US interest, but
it's the Pentagon. The Pentagon's interest.
Unfortunately,
right, gentlemen, let me jump in here. We're going to go to a short break, and after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. Okay, gentlemen, let's stay with this, the Korean Peninsula. One of the things I think is interesting, again, looking how Washington reads this and the think tanks, is that there's the possibility, the tantalizing possibility that they can flip North Korea to join the Western camp. What I think is really interesting is that, first of all, that is not going to happen, and it's probably going to be the other way around. South Korea, and we have this new government under Moon, very popular, 75% approval rating. Mm-hmm. Last year, we had massive protests against the former government, against their policies vis-a-vis North Korea. I mean, Moon has got all of his ducks lined up. And so does Kim. And I think we should focus more on this internal affair among the Koreans. I mean, I looked at some of the pictures here. I was quite moved, to be honest with you, having watched this for so many decades. But the cultural thing, which really, really brought them, they are the same. They really are. They come from the same origins, okay? I thought that was a very nice touch here. I think we could see them becoming the Finlandization of geopolitics.
It's not the first time. In 2000, the president of South Korea got the Nobel, granted by the Nobel.
Kim Dae-jung, yes. Well, in fact, we should not forget who started the whole thing. There were meetings between the North Korean and South Korean presidents in the year 2000. In the year 2007, the group that scrapped the whole peace process was the new conservative government of South Korea, recently headed by Park Geun-hye, you know, the former president, who is now under, well, basically was sentenced to a few years for corruption. So people in Korea, why is there such an approval rating for Moon Jae-in? People want peace, you know. The South Korean government, conservative government, that scrapped the peace process is no longer popular. I don't think it was popular when it did these things. And now there is hope again, and who is destroying that hope? The global West, you know, the collective West.
It's so odd, you know, how everything is flipped. You know, but liberals used to be for peace,
You know, Peter, what it showed, it's the West bombs Syria 2 weeks ago, and they never bombed North Korea. Because they have nuclear weapons. You want to help proliferation of atom weapons?
Nuclear weapons. Yeah.
Thanks to West.
Yeah, Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein can concur on that one right there.
Yes. And Milosevic.
And now, Gaddafi had no prejudice against Sarkozy, unlike Obama. And look what happened to him, right?
Well, he took his money, too. Okay.
We have seen this before. There have been substantial photo ops between North and South Korean leaders. So before we get our hopes too high.
Marco's right. Let's be skeptical. We have to be skeptical.
Yeah. But there are three things that I think make this situation different than the others, and do give me real signs of hope. And the first and most important, is that North Korea obtained a credible strategic deterrent. They successfully developed a nuclear program, nuclear weapons, and ballistic missiles, right? They could deliver of them. They got everything they wanted. They have the strategic deterrent. They could now stand back, cancel tests, and
that's why they can come to the peace table.
With leverage from a position of strength. Secondly, we have a South Korean leader who, God bless him, is willing to see this and still come to the table with a reasonable, rational way of dealing with it because he genuinely wants peace. And he is hated. Moon is hated in the D.C. blob and military establishment. He's despised there. And third, I'm sorry, we have a U.S. president who is incompetent, right? Whatever much may be said, you cannot credit Trump promising fire and annihilation on North Korea as having achieved this. Now, I know that both the South Korean and North Korean leaders have credited him. There's a reason for that. It's because they don't want him to ruin it, and they're hoping by buying him into the process as part of the one who brought it about, that it will be harder for the U.S. to sabotage it. And the U.S. has long been the biggest single obstacle to peace
in the Koreans. And this is one of the reasons why, and I think this is why the North Koreans also said, much to the surprise of many people, that they don't demand an immediate evacuation, withdrawal of all American forces. Because
it's phased.
Right, phased.
Phased. Denuclearization.
And they do know that you can't make that demand, like, say, be gone by the weekend. That's going to be... It's technically impossible.
They are not going to give up any substantial part of their nuclear program until they start to see elements of actual demilitarization on the South Korean and American side.
So this is going to be a long confidence building process. I mean, to undo 68 years of conflict and strife here.
But it's containing Trump. He did the same with Syria actually two times. He first shouting, threatening, and finally he sent some bombs warning Russian where they are more or less where they are going to fall, and it's exactly the same with North Korea. He threatened, he was aggressive, and
I would argue that Trump walked right into Kim's gambit. This is yep. this has been in the works. Mark's absolutely right. Secure your, you know, have a deterrent, secure your sovereignty, have options, have a backer, the Chinese, to some extent, Russia. I mean, if we look at what's being proposed right now, where people are getting all up in a lather, go to the United Nations Security Council at the end of last year when they had a round of sanctions against North Korea, and the ambassador from Russia, the ambassador from China, read these very long statements. No one in the West listened to them. They listened to the garbage and the histrionics of Western ambassadors there. But this plan, what was announced at the end of last year, is being put into place right now.
If we see some genuine progress on this, right, definitely, both leaders of North and South Korea for the Nobel Peace Prize, but
they'll have to give it to Trump too.
Let's also give credit.
Hey, they gave it to Obama for no reason. Okay,
the people, the two other people who did help bring it about, deserve credit are Putin and Xi Jinping.
Yep. Well, if I don't expect it. I don't expect that's going to happen.
If Trump gets it, as some of the U.S. media suggested, then I would say this is in the same chain with Gorbachev and with Obama. You know, look what happened to the countries that they blessed with their peaceful activities.
Well, they gave it to the EU not so long ago, too.
And to OPCW.
That's when it really was a disgrace.
You know,
okay.
In another site, I'm back to Donald Trump, doing as he does. It's frightening, you know, when he started to threaten Northern Korea. He showed to the warmongers in the United States what it could be done if we continue.
You're right. Because that's why I said in my introduction, I mean, not long ago, this would have been a flight into fancy because there's this inability to think in different ways.
We were talking about war just a few episodes ago.
Yeah. But maybe because I can't accept that Trump is stupid, and I would like to imagine that, you know, he's a
I don't think he's stupid. I mean, I've always said, I'm more concerned with the company that he keeps. Okay, yeah. I mean, we have John Bolton around. That's a very dangerous character, an analyst and policymaker that, to my mind, has never gotten anything right ever in his entire career, okay?
Let me find my coffee mug to throw
you. Yeah, he's, you know, a notorious guy that kisses up and spits at people that don't agree with him, okay, his underlings.
Let's not forget that Mike Pompeo was, despite being a Christian fundamentalist and supporting of torture, got enough Democratic votes to be approved as the Secretary of State
this
week.
His first official trip is to where?
To North Korea.
And he wasn't Secretary of State.
He met with the Saudi Arabia. He also has had meetings, and I'm afraid that Pompeo is trying to own this process, and that scares me even more than Trump, because he will try to sabotage it from within.
I'm not a specialist of the United States, of course, but couldn't we imagine that Donald Trump has to give something to the neocons who are, till November this year, I hope.
He just bombed Syria. That's what he gave them.
he bombed, actually, he bombed what? He bombed nothing. He bombed...
We don't even know if the missiles worked. Okay?
Financially, it was the most disastrous thing in the world because they spent $213 million in order to destroy $100,000 worth of Syrian plants and storages. You know, did you see what they destroyed?
76 missiles on plants.
Absolutely.
I want to go back to Donald Trump.
In my opinion, choosing, for instance, Pompeo, choosing Bolton, maybe it's a way for Trump to get some time before the next election, I mean the third of Congress and the House of Representatives in November. Because if the pro-Trump Republicans will win the primaries, if they win on the other representatives. So maybe we will have the beginning of the Trump administration at this time.
But you mentioned this key word, win. And this is what Trump wants. He wants a win.
Yes.
This is the tension. We have Pompeo, we have Bolton, we have always confused Nikki Haley, okay? Always confused. And we have Trump wanting a win. This is the great
tension right now.
They don't need a win. Actually, what they need is not to lose so badly that they lose control of the House and the Senate. And this is why the neocons own the administration, because there are enough neocons that if Trump made a serious divergent from established U.S. militarist policy around the world, there's enough neocon votes to side with the Democrats to impeach him now. That's why all these neocons have been appointed around Trump, because they own the administration by threat of blackmail impeachment.
40 seconds, Stephen.
Well, I just don't know how all of that is going to pass legally, because we have just heard that there was no collusion between Trump and Russians.
Point.
And then what happens to all of these sanctions? Let me remind you that the first sanctions were introduced because of the Russian collusion with Trump's campaign.
So but, if there never, no, but never proven, just never accusations. Proven.
And now the sanctions are going to stay, even though the reason for them has been officially declared by the House's
You're
Intel
probably right,
Committee
Jimmy.
To be
No one even remembers now the reason for the sanctions, only that Russia needs to be sanctioned.
Absolutely.
All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have for this segment of the program. Many thanks to my guests here in Moscow. This is the end of our broadcast segment. Stay with us for the extended version on our YouTube channel. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk rules. Okay, now this is the extended version of our program where we go for political potpourri. Mark, you're up.
Yeah, I think having lived in it for so long, myself being part of the military, we tend to forget the strength that the U.S. military industrial complex has on our government and our foreign policy. And to demonstrate exactly that, I give you Wolf Blitzer. Roll it.
We are refueling the Saudi bombers, so we are essentially part of the bombing campaign. We're helping them choose targets, and we are refueling the Saudi bombers that are dropping the bombs. It is said that thousands of civilians have died in Yemen because of this. Yes, we need to have a debate over this.
So for you, this is a moral issue, because you know there's a lot of jobs at stake. Certainly, if a lot of these defense contractors stop selling warplanes, other sophisticated equipment to Saudi Arabia, there's going to be a significant loss of jobs and revenue here in the United States. That's secondary from your standpoint.
And there you have it. Wolf Blitzer tells us what's really important in the United States. On one hand, we have the moral viewpoint that bombing and invading Yemen at a cost of tens of thousands of deaths, our UN is talking starvation of 14 million is possible, right? Something that could lead straight to genocide.
It reminds me very much of the Mike Morrell thing when, you know, we have to start killing Russians and Iranians. No pushback, no. Are you suggesting, sir, murdering people?
Yeah. You know, on the other hand, we have U.S. jobs. I mean, who will cry for Northrop Grumman? If we don't give these bombs to the Wahhabist terror-sponsoring dictatorship of Saudi Arabia to drop on the poorest country in the world, the children of Yemen, then Americans could lose jobs and U.S. Well, military-industrial complex could lose shares of stock.
It just proves that I've said many times in this program is that there are many in power that have lost any kind of moral compass whatsoever.
Wolf.
Well, international human rights organizations say that at least 123 children die in Yemen every day because of malnutrition, because of the blockade imposed by the Saudis, and because of stray bombs. And after all of that, the U.S. media and the European media, they accuse Russia of exploiting children during their press conference on the proven chemical attack in Duma on April the 7th. What was Russia's crime? Let me just quote what The Intercept wrote about it. Russia flew 17 Syrians from war zone to The Hague on Thursday, where they all testified that they had seen no sign of a chemical attack. End of quote. So the problem is not that they testified that this chemical attack never took place. And let me remind you that the bombings raised were based on that attack. The Russia's crime is to flow in 17 witnesses, including a boy
who was part of the video
filmed.
That was the justification for the U.S. and its client states to bomb Syria.
Including the boy named Hassan Diab, who is seen on that video, you know, presented there as one of the victims of the chemical attack. And what do they write? The Syrians have chosen a boy that had been seen in video recorded by an opposition activist in the immediate aftermath of that.
White helmets, okay.
He hadn't, you know, the problem here is that they write, the boy had been seen in the video. What do you mean? He is on
the video. He's in the center of it.
You can see it. You can check it every second. But, you know, this publication is from The Intercept. So The Intercept is completely enraged about this. They say that Russia manipulated children.
Robert McKay,
exactly. Yeah. And then they write also something else that I think is just hilarious. The boy was described as a witness, and the problem is that the Russians have not reported anything, and their witnesses did not say anything on what took place in a nearby residential building, end of quote. You lied about this hospital. You made a fake video. Mm-hmm. And then you say, this is not relevant. In a nearby building, something terrible happened. And the witnesses are talking about something else. Well, the witnesses are talking about something they saw. It would be a crime if they talked about something that took place in a nearby building.
The Guardian said, obscene masquerade. Russia criticized by them over Duma chemical attack denial. Well, not only Russia was
criticized.
They have
never proven that there was one.
But the 11-year-old child who was part of this faked video did, right? You want to know what an actual obscene masquerade is, right? Bana Abed. It's okay to exploit a child as long as it's supporting our narrative for regime change in theory. The white helmets, right? Gay girl in Damascus, remember that? That is an obscene masquerade. Danny the Syrian? Yeah, that's a masquerade. Richard Engel's kidnapping in Syria? Yeah, that was an obscene masquerade. Moderate jihadis in Syria?
The ultimate masquerade.
That's a masquerade. Claims of impending genocide in Libya? Yeah, that was a masquerade. Colin Powell holding up biological weapons on the floor of the UN Security Council to attack Iraq? The Kuwaiti ambassador's daughter screaming.
Mark,
about
we could devote an entire program to all the masquerades.
Are
okay,
masquerades.
Serbia, everything.
Hold it.
Go ahead.
No, you know, actually, it reminds me again something. It's MH17, because till now there is no evidence that it's the Russian. And in my opinion, the Ukraine army did it. But the huge and aggressive sanctions. What were taken against Russia?
Because
they can just after that. So
it's the pattern. Because I remember that John Kerry went out on all the Sunday news programs, and within hours of the shooting down of the of the Malaysian,
we have some evidences.
But we're
still waiting.
They accuse, but they don't have, and they never show any.
They never reported that before MH17 was shot down. Donetsk was bombed several times, with more people dying there from bombs than people who died in that airport.
Okay, you mentioned Ukraine. Xavier, I'm getting everybody warmed up. I think it's going to be a very hot May in Ukraine.
Yes.
What's going on?
In my opinion, it's a very, very dangerous moment now. Why? Because the weather is good for war, and Kiev has one short time when it can do
before
something.
Before the World
before
Cup.
Before the World Cup. Mm-hmm. To get the same boycott than the Soviet Union get after invading Afghanistan in the 1980. So in my opinion, the next 6 weeks will be very, very dangerous. I'm still optimistic because in my opinion, Kiev are not the resource to start something which can win the war. I mean, if they start something too strong and they got a counterattack, they are counterattacked, who knows where it will be finished? Because don't forget that
the regime's existence is at stake.
Yeah. Exactly. And don't forget that the first unrest was in Kharkov, even not in Donetsk, in Kharkov. Mm-hmm. And how many people living in the Odessa, Zaporozhye, Kharkov,
Russian-speaking regions.
Russian-speaking. Basically. And we are living under the pressure of the police, of the SBU, of the, militias. And what happened is suddenly all the Kievan army start retreating.
Let's talk about what's happening in Ukraine. The Twitter account Defending History, which talks, it's a Twitter account entirely devoted to stopping historical revisionism of what happened in Eastern Europe in World War II and so on. Dateline Ukraine. As Lvov celebrates the 75th anniversary of the founding of the Ukrainian Waffen-SS Galician Division, which they will be celebrating with parades and much fanfare, much as like happens in Estonia.
And a lot of regalia, Nazi regalia.
Today, the Ukraine Post Office adds to the fun by releasing Waffen-SS stamps. Now, let's see if we can get a visual on this here. Note Major Pahabushi, upper right, in full SS Sturmbannfuhrer uniform with Totenkopf on the cap. Now, this is Nazi revivalism funded and armed by U.S. and EU government and taxpayers, right? Remember, there are no Nazis in the Ukraine, right? That's all Russian propaganda, except for the ones they put on their postage stamps.
Last word, one minute, go ahead.
The president of Ukraine Parliament, Andrei Baruby, he's a neo-Nazi. He's a writer, founder, ideological. And this guy met with our Minister of Foreign Affairs. It was months ago. and shake his hand. Ooh. And
at the same time, he met Catherine Ashton and shook her hand.
He met with Justin Trudeau, the great liberal.
He met with
but
Obama.
Again,
even.
There is good Islamist and bad Islamist. There is good Nazist and bad Nazist. As long as you are a good ally with NATO, you can do what you can be.
As long as you're a good liberal, you can think that way.
As Dulles said in the 1950s, when the U.S. was supporting them back then, they're moderate fascists. They are our moderate
fascists. This is
fascists.
A parody of five rationality.
5 seconds for me to say something important. Poroshenko will face election in less than 11 months. His popularity is less than 10%. The only way for him to stay in power is to start a war, unfortunately. The only way. And the United States have no substitute for him.
Yeah, everyone in Ukraine has a popularity lower than that.
All right, on that note here, we've run out of time. That's it for this segment of our program. I'd like to remind you, we'll be gone for a week. We're going to go on vacation, and we'll be back on May 9th, I think. Thank you for watching, and remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, communitypublicradio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.